Ending up with a dialogue between Shankara and Angirasa. Yiddish. Lashonica is now asking that the student had an approach according to Vidhi, had an properly approached the teacher, ask, what is that knowing which one becomes a son of God? Knowing which everything is good going on. That is the question. So that's the question that Angira has to answer with. And so he starts out by saying there are two types of vidya, apara and para. He went through all of the apara vidya really is everything that has to do with what exists within duality, what exists within mind. So everything, all knowledge that involves subject and object. Right? And some of the, all of the disdainers fall into that, and all of the agnas, all of the supporting knowledge from the creators fall into that. The Upanishads themselves fall into that, because somebody can study and learn all of the Upanishads so that you have all of that knowledge available to you, in that you've memorized them and you know what they say. But that level of knowledge is not paravidya. Paravidya has to do with the cognition that involves the recognition of myself. So it's the direct, immediate knowledge of my own nature, of myself as Brahman. That's paravidya. It's not the memorization of the Upanishad, not being able to tell what all of the bhashas say. It's the actual cognition, the removal of the ajnana to ignorance, that has stopped me from recognizing myself. So the actual self-recognition of myself as Brahman, of myself as the whole, that's the paravidya, right? That paravidya takes place through the teaching methodology of the Upanishad that has to do with this sampradaya, this Guru Sisha sampradaya. This is why it's so important to understand. This Upanishad starts out talking about this Guru Sisha Sampradaya, this teaching tradition, taking it all the way back to Ishwara, that teaching tradition that brings about that self-recognition, which is the unfolding of the Upanishads, the knowledge of the Upanishads according to that Sampradaya, using the teaching methodology, that brings about that self-recognition. That's just the reading of the Upanishad. And so that cognition gives me the knowledge that I am the whole. And the question that is being answered that will lead to the recognition that I am the whole is, what is there such a thing, knowing what is that, knowing which everything else is as well known? Right, that's the question. What is that? What is that one thing, knowing which everything is as well known? And so when he started answering that question, he started first by making the definition, the differentiation between apara vidya, which is all of the Vedas, even the Upanishads, all of these secondary knowledges, any subject object type of knowledge. The apara vidya is that self-recognition that takes place through the sampradaya. So it's the use of the Upanishad, right, to bring about this sampradaya, to bring about this recognition. And so after he made this division between apara vidya and para vidya, in this first case that we looked at last class, he starts out defining the apara vidya. We get most of this, so I'll just give the translation of the words. There's two words here that I want to spend some time on before we move into the next verse. So here he's now beginning to actually unfold the nature of that which, knowing which, everything else is as well as. And that's the part of the deal. So, yedtad, that which is adrasham. Adrasham means adrasham, not something that can be seen as an object. So this is one that we work on, adrasham. Agrahyam. Can't be seen as an object through sense perception. It's agrahyam. It's not something that I can touch or handle or grasp. So it's not an object for my sense perception. It's also not an object for my physical body to grasp or do something to the karma indriyas. The ones that the sense organs are negated, right? It's not an object of sense perception. It's not an object that I can touch. It's not an object for the organs of action. That's agrahyam. Then the next one was a Gotram. Gotram means that lineage. Brahman doesn't have a lineage because it's not born. In the Gotra, in India, you know, you can take the Gotra all the way back to the first Rishi, or any individual. You know, this is my father, and his father was so-and-so, and his father was so-and-so, and his father was so-and-so. You take the lineage all the way back. That means you were born, right? You were born, your father was born, your father was born, it was the patriarchy, then your mother was born, and her mother was born, and her mother was born. Born. Brahman has never been born. So there is no lineage. There's no lineage for Brahman. Brahman is Brahman. He doesn't have a prior condition. No prior, no father, no mother. Unborn. That's a Gotram. A Varnam. Varna is an attribute. Could be called a color, for one, the color, like a color. But color stands for any descriptor, like a person is a black, white, or red, or a person is tall or short or fat, a person is smart or stupid, a person has short hair or long hair. And these are all descriptors. Brahman is avarna. There is no descriptor, there is no attribute that would allow Brahman to be differentiated from something else. I can say, you are short and you are tall, you know. Or this is a table and this is a rug. These all things have attributes that allow me to differentiate one thing from another, to describe one thing. Brahman has no attributes. It's not a substantive that has qualities. There's no duality there between substantive and quality. So Brahman is a varna. It's without attributes. Varna is also a word that's used for the caste system. So the varna would be you're born as a brahmana in the priesthood class, or a kshatriya in the warrior class, vaishya, business, shudra, helping professions. You know, helping professions means like maids or servants or secretaries that help people to accomplish what they're doing. Serving profession. So these four castes. What caste is Brahman? Brahman is just a Brahmana or a Kshatriya. The Brahman cannot be described by the caste system. There's no caste. Because it cannot be differentiated by attributes. So these are things we worked on last year. A Chakshu Sarasram. When you say that Brahman is not something that can be looked at, perceived, then you might think that he can't be perceived because he's the perceiver, he's the eternal perceiver, right? If objects take an object of sight, Brahman is not an object of sight, he's the eyes. He's not an object of seeing, he's the sight. He's not an object of hearing, he's the ear. So here, just to make sure you don't think that, it says, Brahman is achakshushrotram, not the ears, not the chakshu's eyes, not the eyes, not the ears. Okay? So not only is not the object of the object seen, it's not also not the sense organs. So Brahman is also not the seer, or the hearer, or the toucher, or the taster, or the feeler. Okay? So those are negators. Then you might think, Brahman is not an object that I can grasp. But he's the one who grasps. Okay? You can't walk to Brahman. You know, he's not an object that you can reach by walking to, but he's the walker. Okay? So, apanipadam. Brahman not only cannot be grasped, he doesn't grasp. He's not an object to be grasped, or something to be touched, or handled, or manipulated through the organs of action. He's also not the organs of action. He's not an object of the organs of action, nor is he the organs of action. He's not an object of sight, nor is he the sense organ. See what I mean? So all of this, seer seen, hearer heard, doer, the doer and the thing done to, both sides are negated. Right? The doer and that which is something, if a doer does something to something, a maker does something to something. So what if I'm not the doer and I'm not the done do? I'm not the seer and I'm not the seen. I'm not the hearer and I'm not the heard. So forfeit all of that from Jada. Then the next one was Nityam. Nityam means just as Brahman is Agotram. Agotram means not born, right? Hasn't been born. It's Nityam, means does it come to an end. So that was, is it born and also does it die? Shameful. So something is not, it doesn't come into being and it doesn't go out of being. Right? And there's no possibility of change there. Because it has to be as it is. Because if it comes into being, then it would be subject to change. Or if being, it could go out of being, then on this side it would be subject to change. But if it can't come into being or go out of being, then it's not subject to change. Right? Because on either side, there's no becoming and there's no ending. So Brahman is free from becoming and free from ending, so free from change. So Nityam. Now, here's the word that I wanted to work on. There's two words. Vibhum. Vibhum, so we'll leave that one aside so I can get rid of these letters. Also, say quickly. Vibhum means that which becomes me. Bhu means to become. Vi means to become differentiated. So, Vibhum means that which becomes me is Vibhum. Okay. Now, so this is one word that we're going to spend some time on today. The next word after that, Vibhum, is Sarvagatam, all pervasive. Because if that one thing, that which is, becomes many, then that one thing that has become many is all pervasive. It would be like, say, the example that's used is if you have, like for the clay pot, if you have a lump of clay and you make out of that clay a pot, right? The clay, which has become the pot, is all pervasive to the pot. See that? So now, if one thing is the, what we'll call the material cause of something, right? Then, if it's the material cause of that something, whatever that something is, the material cause is all pervasive to it. Kind of a strange way of using the word all pervasive, but it's important to understand. If we say that Brahman has become many, okay, and this is why I want to spend some time on this, just think about it for now. If Brahman has become many, that's a material cause, right, which is what we mean by the boom, has become many, then wherever that many is, that material cause is. Right? And so therefore, the material cause is all pervasive to whatever it has become. So if you take a clay and you make, say, a big fresco, which means that you would say a big a scene out of it, you have a lump of clay, and you make a big scene out of it. So say in this lump of clay that you've now made into a fresco, you've got children playing, and you've got the sun, and you've got some trees, and you've got some animals. And so now you would say, this lump of clay has become many. It has become many animals and children. It's become the trees and the stones and the sky and the clouds. Okay? So it's now Vibhum. It's become many. And that clay that is Vibhum, become all of this, it is Sarvagatam. It is all pervasive. Because there is nowhere at all where that clay is not. Right? Because in fact, the only thing that is really there is clay, because it's the material cause. And so now if we say, Brahman is Vibhum, it has become many. And what it means by that is become this entire creation. This Brahman has become this entire creation. It has become many. And it is Sarvagatam. it has become many as the material cause, which means it's sort of a victim. There's nothing else, there's nothing apart from it in any way. Just like clay becoming many, or clay becoming a pot, or gold becoming many chains, that type of thing. There's nothing apart from it. It's all pervasive. Everybody see what that is? It's where when you say material cause, if the material cause becomes something, then that material cause is all pervasive to whatever it has become, to the extent that there is nothing else. Right? Because the clay totally fills the pot, or the clay totally fills the fresco, so it's all pervasive. So that's what's like the thunder. Now it's this next word, susukshma. This Brahman that has become the boom, has become all of this. Now, susukshma means the most subtle. There's nothing more subtle than this. Now just think about this. There's two different ways to look at it. Brahman has become all of this, and it's sort of a gatham. It's all pervasive. It's the very stuff of all of this. Like the clay is the very stuff of the pot, the very stuff of every part of the fresco. Okay. Now, that means that your eyes, for instance, you could say your eyes are more subtle than the forms that they see. They're more pervasive, they're more subtle. You know, like I see through space to see all this in a form of thought modification. So I could even say that the mind is more subtle than the sense organs, because they're more inner. Right? We went through this last week. But now, Brahman is the cause, and sarva-gatam, of what I see, the objects that I see, but it's also the cause and the stuff of the sense organs that are seeing them. Right? And it's the cause and the sarva-gatam, all pervasive in the very stuff of the mind, right? That is using the sense organs. And so how can the mind or the sense organs see what they are? You know, it's like, you just imagine, again, the clay fresco. You've got the clay person there looking over at the other little person, right? They're seeing each other, and they're thinking and this and that. You have to use your imagination. They're thinking and this and that. But the very stuff of them, right? The very stuff of the mind, the stuff of the sensuality, the stuff of the object, is Brahman. Right? Brahman's not seeing anything. Brahman is the very stuff that's allowing all of this, the very being of it all, of all of it. So it is the most subtle. The sense organs can't look at Brahman. They are Brahman. The objects are not, it's like this. The sense organ, the mind is Brahman. The sense organs are Brahman. The objects that are seen are Brahman. There is nothing that is not Brahman. And so how can Brahman be seen when there is nothing that is not Brahman? So my eyes can see these forms. The eyes are Brahman, the sight is Brahman, and the objects seen are Brahman. The whole thing is Brahman. This is why, you know, it becomes such a, this is a good way to help you get beyond the idea of wanting to have an experience. We want to have an experience of Brahman so we can become enlightened. But now, what if you say like this? Okay, now, let me tell you what Brahman is, and then you tell me how we're going to have an experience of Brahman. Okay? I am Brahman. I am seeing you. And you are Brahman. I am Brahman. The eyes are Brahman. The seeing you is Brahman, and you are Brahman. Okay? So I am Brahman, and you are Brahman. And the perception of you is Brahman. And the thought modification of you is also Brahman. Okay. So now, how are we going to have an experience of Brahman? How can you get out of Brahman to have an experience of Brahman that is not already here? know. It's like, it's, think of the clay fresco. That one little clay character says to another, I really want to have an experience of clay.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Maybe if we meditate, we can have an experience of clay. So that I can be enlightened. Now, how is it possible? How is it possible? Because for one, the little clay figure is clay that wants an experience of clay. The sense organs are clay. The mind is clay. The self that they're meditating on is clay. There's nothing that isn't clay. Where are they going to go that isn't clay? Where is the non-clay to have an experience of clay? So where is the non-Brahman to have an experience of Brahman? You have to find, there has to be a non-Brahman there to gain an experience of Brahman. You see what I'm saying? Where are you going to go? There is nothing else but Brahman. So it's not about having an experience of Brahman. You can't, because there's nothing that isn't Brahman for you to have that experience. But the experience is already what is. The experience is already 100% totally, completely here. You can't make it any more than it is because there isn't anything outside of it. So there's nowhere to go. Then it's a question, well, how do we have an experience of Brahman then? There we are again. How do we do that then? How are we going to have that experience? It's not about having an experience. It's about recognizing what is here. It's not about gaining an experience. It's about recognizing what is the constant. You know, what is the constant stuff of all experience? What is actually here that is invariable and constant that you can't get rid of? There's all of these nama-rupas, all of these names and forms, all of these thoughts, all of these perceptions, all of these different states of mind, all of these emotions, quiet mind and agitated mind, all kinds of stuff. Quiet, think of the clay fresco, you know, quiet clay and agitated. Clay is not changing. There's nothing there but the clay. You can't get rid of it. So you have to recognize what, no matter what is going on, in all this change, it's called Maya, we'll get that down in a minute. What is all that's going on, what is the invariable? What is the invariable in your experience? What is the clay? What is the sattva-gatam? All pervasive, it's there in the subject, it's there in the object. See or seeing, seeing. That is Brahman. So you say, well, if I want to have an experience of Brahman, if I am Brahman and you are Brahman, then what is that experience? Because when we want to have an experience of Brahman, and then we're going to go somewhere. See what I'm saying? But there is nowhere to go that isn't Brahman. There's nowhere to go. So Brahman is here, right here. Right here. Right here. That's not about experience. It's not about being an experience. It's about recognizing the constant being that you are right here and now. Huge thing to understand. It's more than a huge thing to understand. It's the whole thing. It's the whole thing. And when this whole thing is not understood, then nothing is understood. Literally. Literally nothing is understood. That's why it's so critical. So anyway, so vibhu, this is an important word. What the heck? So that's susukshma. Susukshma is an important word too. That which is so subtle, be more subtle, because non-objectifiable. It's more subtle than the eyes, it's more subtle than the mind, it's more subtle than the perception, because it's the very self of it. Right? It's not something you can objectify because it is the very being, the very step of the whole thing. So it is the most subtle. There's nothing behind it. It is. It is the very step. So it's the sukshma. Then, tad avyayam. And this word avyayam, it really means navyati. That which doesn't wane. That which doesn't decay or change. In any way. It doesn't dissipate or change or go away. Navyati. So changeless. That is changeless. Okay, so this is going to be something. That which is changeless becomes all of this. Okay. All of this is all changing, so we're going to have to understand that. How can that which is changeless doesn't change at all? It's not born. It doesn't die. Does it come into being? Does it go out of being? And being here, it doesn't change. If it did change, it would be dying. Something changes, it's a death of what it was before, because it's changed. So here it says, does it come into being, so there's no change there, does it go out of being, there's no change there. So just to make sure it says that it doesn't change in the middle, not that it could. Okay? But it means that which is, Brahman is, and it is changeless. Now, really in a sense, it is and it is changeless. Means that the Brahman that you are, that which is right now, this right now is permanent. That's what changeless means. The right now, this being, is free from time. Changeless means free from time. It means that the being that you are now, this now is forever. Because there is no forever. There's no time. So it's a changeless presence. Who you are now is the changeless presence. If we were to look at from the standpoint of this creation and go back in time, you know, go back in time a billion years in time, there's no age for you. The being that you are right now is the being that is present a million years ago from the standpoint of what's going on in the creation. That's what we mean by changeless. So the being that you are now is the being that you are, period. Free from time. So tad avyayam. Now, here's the word. Yad bhutayonim. The boom means that which becomes many. Bhutayonim is the yoni, the cause for becoming many. The one who makes many. The yoni means the womb. The yoni is the womb. The womb for the one who gives birth to all of this. So if we take these two words, the vibhum, the one, the becoming many, and the bhuta yoni, it can be looked at, these two words, as definition of Brahman, can be looked at as what we call the material cause and the efficient cause. We say that Brahman is the material cause and the efficient cause of his creation. So let's see what we mean by that. Material cause is very simple. It just means like the clay is the material cause of the pot. It means the very stuff of which something is made. Is the material cause. The very stuff of the pot is clay. The very stuff of the golden chains is gold. That's the material cause. It's called, in Sanskrit, it's called upadana karana. Now, when we have something as a material cause, like gold or pot, we can see clearly that the object is made of that. That's what it is. We want then to say, well, okay, we have the material cause of this object. And then we have, for a pot, we have the one who creates the object. And so there's a material pot, clay. There's the material cause of the pot, clay. And then there's the pot maker. Or there's a gold chain. There's a material cause, gold. And then there's the jeweler for the artist that makes the chain. Two are not the same. The pot maker and the pot are not the same. If I were to build a cabinet, the wood is different than the one who creates it. But here, Brahman is revealed in the Upanishads, the position of the Upanishads. Brahman is revealed as the material cause of the creation, like the clay is the material cause of the pot, which means that there is nothing here but Brahman, all pervasive. There is nothing here but Brahman. But Brahman is also the pot maker. In other words, the what we call the efficient cause. In Sanskrit, it's called nimitta kavana. The upadana kavana and the nimitta kavana. The material cause and the efficient cause. The clay and the in Pashana Shi, they use an example, a nice example for that, just like a dancer. A dancer uses her own body. The dancer becomes both the material cause of her creation, which is her own body during the dance, and also the efficient cause, the intelligent principle. And so here, when we look at the entire creation, we look at Brahman as both material cause and the efficient cause. There is nobody outside of Brahman. Otherwise, what happens is Brahman becomes the clay, and then who's responsible for the creation? And but now, just think of it. If we look at Brahman as the material cause and the efficient cause, how does that come to be? There's a little problem here. There's a problem because in our experience, if you say Brahman is just pure, changeless being, it can't change to become this creation. It's not a seer, and it's not a doer. Right? It doesn't see, it doesn't do, it isn't born, it doesn't change, and it doesn't die. Right? Talking about your being, it's totally free from any type of change. If it's totally free by its nature of any type of change, it can't vivum. It can't become this creation. So how is it that it becomes this creation? How is that even possible? So the next verse is going to deal with that, but I'm going to say a few things about it first, and then we'll do the next verse next week. First of all, this verse ends with Paripashyanti Dhiraha. Those dhiras, those people who are adhikaris, who have the viveka, ability to discriminate, have emotional maturity, so they can see those people, Paripashyanti, they see clearly. They see this Brahman clearly. Who is this Brahman that they're seeing? That one, knowing which all things are known. That's going to run through now. That one, knowing which all things are known. So it's this Brahman that the teacher is revealing now. So now, if you think about that, knowing that one thing, which all things are known, first of all, that one thing has to be you. Just think about it. If there is one thing, knowing which all things are known, then there is nothing that is apart from that one thing. And if that one thing becomes many, there's some logic, there's a lot of logic and things to understand in these words. Now think like this. And this is something that's revealed by the Upanishads. The Upanishads want you to, it's revealing a certain vision to you that it wants you to see and understand. If there's one thing that becomes many, we become many, like a parent becomes many. A parent could have many children, and their children could have many children. So you can become many. But you aren't going, becoming many in that way, you're not going to be all pervasive. Right? And knowing you, I don't know all your children. Or knowing one of your children or your grandchildren, I don't know all the other children and grandchildren. So it can't be that type of one becoming many. It's one becoming many and being all pervasive to those many. So that means material cause. That's what the vibhum means. It becomes many as a material cause. And that material cause is all pervasive. All pervasive of what? Of this creation. Now, are you included in this creation? Yes. If that vibhum, if that Brahman, which becomes this whole creation, had sense organs, then it would be separate, right? It would have two eyes looking up, yeah. No sense organs. If it was your sense organs and my sense organs, it's not vibhum. It's not all pervasive. If it could grasp, then it's an object in the creation. That's not vibhum. It has to be the one stuff which is not subject to change. If it's subject to change, then it's on that side or this side or there or that. Okay? So it has to be the whole. Now, if it is the whole, that one has become many, right? Then it has to be me, because it's one that has become many. There's no other place for me. You see what I mean? I can't be outside of that. And so that means that I have to be that. Now, if I am that, how am I going to find it in myself? How am I going to find it? If I am that, where will I look? Where will I look to see it? Can I look inside? The one who's looking is already it. The one who's there won't look and look inside. The one who's looking is it. The looking is it, and what is being looked at is it. Okay? And so, what am I looking at? The whole thing is already it. You see what I'm saying? Now, that's why we say this vibhum, this one. Swamiji will use the word, it's self-evident. I can't look at it. Does that mean that I can't know it? I can't look at it because the seer sees seeing is all it. But there's no looking at it because it's already there, involved in that whole thing. You see what I'm saying? So then how is it known? It's known because it's self-evident consciousness. It's me. There's no one to know it. It is self-evident. It's the bottom line. In other words, just say like this. Is there consciousness here? Yes. If I say, I know you, right? I am a knower, a seer, so it's like seeing you. Okay? So you are in consciousness. The seeing is in consciousness. The seer is in consciousness. The mind is in consciousness. What is consciousness in? What is consciousness in that allows consciousness to be known? Nothing. That's what we mean by self-evident. Consciousness is its own experience. Nobody is knowing it. It is the experience itself. Okay, so now, just think, everybody do this. I know you. Okay? I am in consciousness. The knowing is in consciousness. You are in consciousness. So there's known consciousness, knowing consciousness, knower consciousness. There's nothing that's away from consciousness. Now what is that consciousness? And who knows it? Who knows the consciousness? Nobody knows the consciousness. The consciousness is self-evident. You see what I'm saying? There's nobody knowing it. So what is this self-evident consciousness? That is Brahman. The self-evident consciousness, that means you are known, the space is known, the body is known, the sense organs are known, my mind is known, there's a consciousness, 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 object consciousness, consciousness, knowing consciousness, body consciousness, sense organs consciousness, mind consciousness, consciousness, subject object consciousness. There's nothing here but consciousness. That consciousness is Brahman. There's no, you can't get more of an experience of it than it's already here. So I know you. That's Brahman. Very simple. I know you. That's Brahman. There's nothing more to say. There's nowhere else to go. There's no more experience to be had. Right? You say, and you can say that about everything. This emotion is consciousness. Okay? This next emotion is consciousness. This next emotion is consciousness. This thought is consciousness. This perception is consciousness. The one that's having the perception is consciousness. The perception is consciousness. You can't get away from the consciousness. What is the consciousness is the invariable. The emotion comes and goes. This emotion is in consciousness. This emotion, this emotion, this emotion, this emotion, this emotion. The consciousness is invariable. It doesn't change at all. And the consciousness is the same for the subject and it's the same for the object. Nothing ever happens. It's always exactly the same. There's no variance at all. You can't get away from it. There's nothing that you can do about it. That is Brahman. And that Brahman, you can't, there's nowhere to go to have another experience of it. Or you want to have a more, a deeper experience. There is no deeper experience. Because it's non-dual. There's not two kinds of consciousness. You want to have a blurred experience. Well, that's all right. We can work that way. We can get you a blurred experience. It's a blurred experience. Brahman is having a Brahman blur. Brahman bliss and Brahman misery. The Brahman is invariable. The Brahman is invariable. Brahman, bliss consciousness, misery consciousness. You know? Love consciousness, hate consciousness. The consciousness is invariable. It's invariable to the bliss, it's invariable to the hate. It's the hater and the haters. It's the lover and the loved. You know? It's the invariable. That's the Vibhuti, the one that's the Sarvagata Sona. The all that all pervasive. You cannot get away from it to experience it. Oh, does that mean it's not experience? No. That's like saying, is this not an experience? I see you. Is there not self-evident consciousness here? Am I not here? Am I not here? No, I am here. I am here. But the amness of the seer is the amness of the seeing. So let me put it like this. The isness of the seer is the isness of the seeing. The amness of the seer is the amness of the seeing. There is no amness and isness. Amness and isness are the same word. So I can say, I is and you is. I is, you are, you is. And Ishira is. Or I am, you am, and Ishira am. The am experience, so what we call is, isness, it is, 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 you are, you are, you are, you are, and I am. So there's an am, are, and is. There is no am, are, and is. There is only am. There is only am. I am and you am. Try to objectify, to look, try to objectify isness. There's no object isness. There's only amness, and that amness, is it known? Yes. Is it known as an object?
No.
It is known because it is consciousness. Consciousness, amness, and meanness are all the same. They're all words pointing just to your being. And that's being. And so this whole verse is looking at the nature of the self from the standpoint of Ishvara. Talking about defining Brahman. Brahman as the upadana and nimitta kalana, the material cause and the efficient cause of this whole creation. To get now to the efficient cause, we'll do it next week as we move into this verse. We need to bring in Maya. We need to bring in Maya. That which allows for the manifestation of all of these names and forms that have no separation whatsoever from consciousness. But in the end, what do we have to recognize? What is the Jivan Mukta really? Somebody, Dhiraha, somebody really has this knowledge. We want to just recognize it because it's all Brahman. And that includes me. When these upadis, this body, mind, sense organ, the body, the mind, the sense organ, your body, mind, sense organ, all of these things that belong, that are part and parcel of the creation, all are, you know, jigun, one being. And that's what needs to be seen. So remember the question, knowing which everything is known. What is that? What is that? Knowing which everything is known. That can only be myself, because if there's one thing, then there is nothing else to be known. There is no me outside of that one thing. So we can, if it's not, that things just somehow slip by us. But if there's one thing, and so I can know it. Because there's two. Right? If I can know it as an object, it's not one thing anymore. There's two. If there's one thing, then that one thing is me. And that one thing is the self of the knower and the known. And so now where is knowing? That one thing has to be self-evident. It has to know itself. It has to be self-shining. But there's not one thing is two. And so then how do we gain knowledge of it? We don't. We remove the ignorance. It's a lot different. So what does it mean to gain knowledge? Do we gain another knower? Then there's two. We don't gain another knower. Recognize the nature of myself, which is the very content of the knower. See that? That's really amazing. So let's stop there and then we'll go on to this next year. There's some technical things I want to get into. I only did the myth that we called on the Karana, but it's Jivan and Bhutayani. We need to get into the Vibharta Upadana Karana, which is how the material cause, Karana can be the material cause of the creation without undergoing any change. So Maya has to come in here. Purnamadaya Purnamirvam Shishyate Would you say that consciousness is the rock bottom place to get from an or existence? The way it seemed you unfolded it was in the midst of or Upadana Karana is the existence, and then from there see the consciousness in it. But did you see what I'm saying? Does it matter? You know?
Well, you know, in existence is consciousness, consciousness is existence.
Mm-hmm.
When you're unfolding it, you will go through one, go through existence and end up at consciousness, and go through consciousness and end up at existence.
Mm-hmm. I think.
You know, so I would say, you can go either way. Yeah. And, but in the end, they both have to come together as one. Neither can be objectified. We have two words. We have two words, existence, it is, it is, it is, it is. But the only reason we have the two words is because I can say everything is, but then I won't say that everything is conscious. I am and I am conscious, but the rug is not conscious. So there's a differentiation within Maya between the conscious and inert, right? And so what has to happen is that we need to recognize that the whole Maya, the whole Jagat creation, is in consciousness which is existence. The consciousness which is existence is the being of the entire creation. But not everything in the creation reflects consciousness. Everything enjoys the being, and everything is in consciousness, but not everything reflects consciousness. Just like if you have a thought or an imagination, the whole thought is in consciousness. Everything is known. So it reflects consciousness in the sense that it's known, but not everything has a sukshma sharira, subtle body, for itself to be like a mirror reflecting consciousness. So some things have subtle bodies and they reflect consciousness and they say, I am, I'm the sacred being. And then the poor rug and chair, you know, they don't have a situation here to have that. And so that's why we make it, we as jivas, who don't have knowledge, we see consciousness and existence as different because this is a conscious, I'm a conscious. So there's a false division that's made there. Yeah.
I'd like to ask another question. Is then all of this, the creation, is it simply karma playing out? Maya, I know you're going to unfold it next week, but it's all, there's an order, there's an intelligence. So it's karma.
You can say it's karma, it's the sameshi karma of all the jivas put together from the standpoint of what's going on within the creation. You're going to look at Ishwara having karma, but it's just the infinite expression but then of Ishwara. But then from within the creation, every jiva has karma that's being played out within that infinite expression. And that karma is beginning with.
And so as an individual with a mind, then seeing the order in things as they take place, then I'm within that order and I'm not in conflict with it.
You more and more you appreciate the order of Ishwara. And it's enjoyable and easy to appreciate it when you're not trying to aim it to be different. Like say when you're an ananda or your well-being is depends on Ishwara being a particular way that I can have this and not that, you know. Where your ananda is dependent on a certain Ishwara being a certain way, Krishna being a certain way, then it's not so easy. But when your mind, when that nishtha is there, then the source of wholeness or ananda is really the self. And all of this is an expression of that. So you're not asking Ishwar to be in a particular way. You can kind of enjoy the order as it is. And you can enjoy more, you see not how Ishwar is supposed to be, but you keep learning how Ishwar is. A whole different attitude. Yeah? Oh, Ishwar is supposed to be like this. As though we know how Ishwar is supposed to be. If this is happening, then this is not away from Ishwar. It's not a question of Ishwar is not supposed to be like this, because here it is.
So even with the environmental catastrophe we're going through, how should you look at that?
It's Ishwar.
And not be disappointed that that's the way Ishwar is?
We can be disappointed, maybe, that we're so stupid. I'm saying that. but there are laws, you know. The things that first are in those laws. Yeah. And it's an infinite creation.
Yeah.
And infinite time. And this is a brilliant law.
There's supposed to be so many galaxies that there are a number of grains of sand on the Earth. I mean, that's humongous. I keep thinking that we're worth that. I mean, this is an important place.
Every place in the creation feels that way, because that is the nature of the soul.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, that's the origin of that just being important.
I would love to get some around that. Is the human being, though, the center of all the karma? The human mind, where karma can take place, the human mind, and then all this whole creation of the fallout from that? I know that's a ridiculous question, but I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know quite how to answer that, except to say, like, if we say that the human being, this particular loka, is the loka where karmas are accrued. Not just exhausted, but accrued. That's called the bull loka, when you have this particular type of upadhi. And so here we are all, here, in this particular plane of existence, and we're all here together, which means that we are all very interconnected, because we've come down to this particular plane of existence at this particular time on this earth, which is a relatively small planet. You know, here we are in the same place, in the same time, with all of these people, that some that we know closely, like ourselves, that we know each other. But then there's the different governments and the different peoples in the world and the different interactions that are taking place. We're all part of that. We've all come here together, and we're all playing our part in it. You know, so there's a collective karma for this entire group of everybody that's here right now, including all the insects and everybody. Everybody that's here right now, there's a collective karma. And some of it is touching you more immediately than others, but we've come together in this particular time and place, and so we have something to do with the whole thing, to either... We're participating in it. We're experiencing the karmas of it, and we're participating in it in whatever way we are. Maybe the birth that you took, there's certain karmas that you're exhausting, so you have a part that you're playing in it. Everybody has a part that they're playing in it.
The choice that the human mind makes has so many reverberations in the whole... What were you calling universal karma?
Yeah, everything. It's an infinite network.
But isn't the human mind the real center for karma?
Well, without the mind, of course, you wouldn't have the free will to be doing karmas. And we don't say in the shastra, animals for instance are just exhausting karma. Mm-hmm. They're living out according to nature. They're not their nature. But they're not accruing karmas. they don't have the same type of free will. It's not that they don't have emotions or consciousness. I mean, they do. And they're four and more accepted. But the Shastra doesn't accept that the animals have free will, that they're exhausting free will. They say that they're not utilizing free will, they're exhausting karma. But the human mind is exhausting karma and creating karma. It's part of the free will, you're responsible for your actions. So you're not only having results of your karma, so you're also accruing punyan papa because of your choices.
And that brings up a question, because like, you know, I'm riding my bicycle a lot, you know, and it's like people, you know, sometimes it's very dangerous, you know, people are on the phone during the corner, and I feel like they're not present, you know what I mean? And so I really get enraged, you know, because like it's either I get run over, right, or I yell at them. Either way, it's not ahimsa, you know? But so you take the better of the two, because like, I'm being ahimsa to myself by saying, hey, stop. Don't ride over me, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but there's nothing wrong, like, say you're driving along and the car's going to hit you, they're not aware of that, see you.
Yeah.
It's not a lack of ahimsa to say stop. But if you start swearing at them and you're going to the whole station.
I say stop very firm. Because some people, you know, it's like they're not paying attention at all. So I don't know, I'm very confused about it, you know, because I got a step, the better I get a step.
And get a step.
I'm not willing to do more bicycle riding. So it's a very confusing issue because, like, I don't want to be creating more bad karma, right?
No, but you just said, you just told me you gave away the whole
program. Yeah.
You said, I got upset because I got upset.
Yeah.
So the problem isn't at all trying to stop them from hitting me. That's objective. But the problem is getting upset. And get them getting upset that you're upset. So there's a couple of
things. I'm saying two things here. You get that I get upset that I fell to stop.
Well, why should you get upset?
Because like I don't plan to be politically correct when I'm going to get hit in the moment.
Well, there's a couple of things here, though. If you know that driving the bike in this area is dangerous, so you have to know that this is dangerous. So now you have to take precautions. And know that these cars, that the people are talking on their cell phones and they're listening to audio tapes and doing this and doing that and maybe only paying 40% of their attention on the road. That's a reality. Okay. So, and you're choosing to ride your bike in this reality. So now when you make that decision, you can't get mad at these people. You have to say, I'm riding in this dangerous situation. What do I have to do to be careful so that I don't get hit? And that means that you have to know, these people, they've only got like 40% consciousness here. So you have to be ready to honk your horn, your bike horn, or to yell out, or to protect yourself.
Protect myself.
Yeah, so there's nothing ahimsa in that. Once you accept the reality, this is how you have to ride your bike in the situation. And to me, yelling at them, hey, move over, blah, 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 it's just like you. If you don't want to do that, then get on a horn that you honk.
Yeah, get a truck airplane.
Yeah, it's much more intense than that, though. I mean, the guy who's this way, you know, this way.
But what would you say about this idea of getting upset or getting upset? Yes, sir.
It's a really wonderful thing when that goes.
Yeah.
Because when that goes, what replaces that is objectivity and compassion.
Not getting upset because you're upset?
Yeah, because what will replace that is that compassion and mentoring.
No. I know that place. But it seems to be very intense. You know, it comes up very quickly.
But then when you see you're getting upset over you're getting upset,
yeah,
then you can have compassion over the one who's getting upset over getting upset.
Yeah.
at some place, the compassionate person has to come in and say something. You know.
Well, no, but the real question, so see very clearly, obviously we're not talking about
paripiti.
Yeah, paripiti.
It means knowing.
No, it's just cognitive. You said cognitive. What is that?
It means that your mind sees it and understands.
So this is seeing we're talking about.
Yes. Clarity. It's not seeing through the eyes, recognizing. You see clearly.
It's similar to that.
Yes. When you see something clearly, it means your mind sees it, it gets it, it understands it. And putty question, see, putty means all the way around. You know, I used that example last week of the Amor Bruce. When you look at it, you see all the way around. You see clearly from all sides, you see it, you understand it.
I come to this point a lot, but this word vibhum is bringing it up again, and this all pervasive nature when it
in terms of material forms,
right?
Yeah.
So if it's, and I think you touched on this a little bit, but I missed what you were saying, was if it's already whole and complete, then why is there a vibhum? If all there is one,
yeah.
So why is there?
There is no reason. There's no reason.
But if there's an intelligence behind it, then that's
inferred. We have to look at intelligence because you're using intelligence from your standpoint as though somebody thinks intelligence
okay.
In terms of the thinker. Yeah, we're using intelligence in terms of consciousness and the expression of knowledge from Ishwara. I'll talk about that next week.
I'm still lost on this. There is no reason for it, because if there's no reason, then why ethics, why morals, why?
Well, when you get the ethics and morals and dharma from within the creation, right, then there's ethics and morals and dharma because there's pain. Certain things cause pain.
Right, but if everything in the creation is from this non-dual,
uh-huh.
And there's no reason, and that no reason is present in all of this as well, is it not?
Well, what I meant by no reason is that there's no first cause, right? In other words, if Brahman, the
mm-hmm.
nature of itself, is beginningless and changeless, but Brahman's not going to have a reason because it's beginningless and changeless. When did it start having a reason? If there's no time there. And say if we look at the Maya, which we really talked about this
mm-hmm.
now in this series, I could talk about it. If Maya is, not, there's no beginning to Maya, where is the reason? There's not going to be a reason when something always has been. We have the reason in terms of a cause, something that comes into being.
Mm-hmm.
And then there has to be somebody who thought to bring it into being. But if there's no beginning, there's nobody thinking, oh, I'm going to begin now. It's already there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so then it's a matter of how something is, what something is, not why it came into being. You can't answer the question why it came into being because it always is. And if you're beyond time, then this cause and effect, that the reason doesn't exist. It exists within the creation. And so then you look at within the creation and you try to understand what dharma is and a dharma. Yeah. There's such a thing as inequality in this creation. There's pain and suffering in the creation. There's emotional pain, right? And then there's pleasure and happiness. So what is the cause for this inequality? What is the cause for the opposites? What is the cause for pleasure, pain? Then we have cause, because now we're within time.
That's Maya.
Yeah, well, right. But within Maya, when there's this pleasure, pain, what causes pleasure? What causes pain? And we can answer that. That's where Dharma comes in.
So I guess my real question, without maybe trying to dance around it, is then what is, why the creation? Why is this? Why are we here?
Because this is the nature of Ishwara. This is the nature of Ishwara. And then you can say, well, why is this the nature of Ishwara? Well, how can you answer that? Because did Ishwara decide? Did Ishwara create himself? In your FFO? Who created Ishwara? And then you say, well, Ishwara is God. Nobody created God. And then you say, well, did God create himself? Well, if God created himself, he was already there. So God, nobody created God, and God didn't create himself, and then, well, if God didn't create himself, then how can you ask, why is God like God is? Why is Ishwara like Ishwara is? Nobody created Ishwara, and Ishwara didn't create himself. Ishwara is like Ishwara is because it is Ishwara. There's nobody that made a decision there, because we're talking about where it's beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a huge thing to understand. It's very freeing, actually, because people will say, why is Ishwara like this? Or Ishwara shouldn't do that.
He should protect the good people.
Ishwara should be... It's kind of a Christian conditioning in thousands of years. The good God. The good God and the devil. Right? The split. The good God and the devil. And then we see Ishwara behaving like this. Ishwara is supposed to be the all-loving, all-divine God. But Ishwara is the whole. So there's something, a different way of understanding Ishwara and all of the laws. And Brahman, the truth of it all, is beyond good and bad. Brahman is Ananda, is wholeness. And Ishwara as a whole is wholeness. But the Jesus get kind of ground up, that verse in the Katha Upanishad that says at the end of, I think, maybe chapter. It says, our Lord Yama is eating, is the chutney for the creation. Because creation keeps changing, right? So everything is being ground up. For the ones that are being ground up, that's not so much fun. And we're all being ground up, right? We're all in the queue. Right, from the standpoint of the root causes. But that's not true for yourself, for the truth of it all. Just like you think of the dream that everything's changing and all hell can be breaking loose in the dream, but when you wake up, you realize nothing has happened. Where all the only thing that's there in front of you, absolutely nothing has happened. In spite of all of this happening, nothing's happened to the being. It's the truth of it. And we have to recognize that. That I am the whole of this, in the same way that in hindsight you can look at the dream and say, that's me. You look at the dream and, you say to me, that's only me. The whole thing came from me, the same body, it resolved into me. There's nothing but me there. You have to have that same drishti. Here, but the vision is the vision. To have that, you need to have a lot of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just pretend like you have that. You have to, there's a lot of understanding that goes into seeing, to actually seeing that paripashyanti, the jira paripashyanti, actually see, I am the whole, to know that. Not just completely clearly. So as you're looking at it and experiencing all of this theology, you see. Yeah, that's
what you're going to do. So I'm going to stand here to ask you something. I'm glad you answered this question, because I had brought that up. Say this for the Swami D, and you said, question's not tenable.
It's not tenable.
Yeah, you can't can't really ask the question because there's no answer.
But this is what that means. When you say it's not tenable, it's not tenable, and there is no answer for it, because once you're into the timeless, it's beginningless. Those questions only are tenable or can be answered within time.
But it's such a fundamental question of human nature.
Yeah, but if that makes sense to you, it's untenable, it shouldn't be asked. Okay, that's probably not saying enough. Because then you have to understand what he means when he says it's untenable. It doesn't mean that it can't be answered, it is being answered. It is untenable. You can't, there is no cause. When you're beyond time, you have to look for cause and effect. When there's no time, you can't do that. Because that's not possible to answer that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If the question is not proper. But the question is not proper, that it's untenable, has to be unfolded so that you feel that your question is answered.
Well, yeah, I mean, I understand that once you ask that question, you're in this time, continuum. But yet it seems like this is what the Vedas are there for, is to explain that very...
That's true.
That very thing.
And it is being explained.
So
I'm explaining it right now.
Right, yes. So to say it's untenable, though, it seems a bit abrupt.
It is abrupt. It is abrupt unless it's unfolded.
Right.
Within me. Yeah. You could say it's an untenable question, inappropriate question, then you have to explain why.
Mm-hmm.
Then you were probably a little upset. Oops.
Yeah.